from the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the Toronto Film Festival is over, wrapping up after festivals in Venice and Telluride. So how is award season now shaping up? Then I hang out with Robbie Robertson at his studio in West LA. He shares the inspiration behind his latest record and recalls when his group, The Band, played at Woodstock.
They wanted to roll in the mud. They wanted to get crazy. And when we went and played, it was like somebody coming and doing hymns.
And we say farewell to Rick Ocasek. All that coming up on The Frame. The Toronto International Film Festival ended last night. Brett Lang of Variety has been in Canada covering the influential festival, and he joins me now. So, Brent, which film won the coveted People's Choice Award?
Well, the winner was Jojo Rabbit, and I think a lot of people were pretty surprised that that was selected because coming out of Toronto, the reviews weren't that great. They were pretty mixed, and there was a consensus that Fox Searchlight might have stumbled a bit out of the gate. This morning, it looks like they may actually have a really viable awards contender.
This is Taika Waititi's film about a young boy in Germany who thinks he wants to be a member of the Hitler Youth Brigade, and his assumptions about Hitler and Nazis are challenged. I was a big fan of the film, but it was obviously incredibly polarizing. But I think it does prove that some things can happen at Toronto that can be really beneficial for a film. And I'm really thinking about Hustlers, Laureen Scafaria's film with Jennifer Lopez that opened this weekend, did great business, has attracted really good reviews. It really feels like Toronto helped launch that movie. Do you buy that theory?
Absolutely. I think what's interesting about Toronto is, like, unlike Cannes or some of the other film festivals, there's a real populist undercurrent. And the people who are there really want to love films. You can sort of feel it in the audience. When people sit down, they're so rooting for the filmmaker. In Cannes, it's the opposite. You almost feel like they're almost excited to be able to throw tomatoes or baguettes or whatever at the screen. So it's a very different feeling, and I think that's often reflected in the kinds of movies like Hustlers, like Jojo Rabbit, that are really embraced there.
And yet, if a movie doesn't play well in Toronto, it's probably never going to play well anywhere. And it feels like The Goldfinch is a good example of that.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that one really stumbled out of the festival, just huffing and puffing and wheezing. And indeed, look at the box office. Less than $3 million opening weekend. That was a film that just really collapsed.
I want to ask you about a couple of films that played other festivals, including Telluride. Two of these movies are from Netflix, The Two Popes and Marriage Story. It does feel that, unlike Cannes, Toronto welcomes movies made by streaming services. How did Marriage Story and Two Popes come out of Toronto?
They came out looking like Oscar frontrunners. What's really interesting is Netflix is starting to come into its own. I mean, that sounds strange because it's not like they haven't had awards contenders in the past, like Roma or Mudbound, but those movies were almost acquisitions. These are more kind of Netflix productions from inception to when they actually make it to the big screen. So I think you're seeing a much higher degree of quality, and that's very important for Netflix because when you look ahead, Disney Plus is launching in a couple of months. You've got Warner Media launching a stream service. It's going to get a lot more competitive, so that quality needs to be there, and they should be feeling much more confident after Toronto.
In January, the Sundance Film Festival is a big market for movies that are made outside of the studio system. It felt like there wasn't that much action among sales agents at Toronto. Is that because there weren't that many movies for sale, or people were looking at some of the films that sold at Sundance, like Late Night and Blinded by the Light, that didn't do a lot of business and were maybe a little more tentative?
I think it's a bit of both. I think there were plenty of films for sale. I'm not sure there were plenty of films for sale that were terribly cinematic, and that scared off a lot of buyers. And then I think a lot of people were also wary of making the same mistakes that some of the companies did at Sundance, where they really overpaid for movies like Blinded by the Light, like Late Night, like, unfortunately, it appears Brittany Renz, A Marathon is also going to be one of these movies that just have kind of iffy commercial prospects, even if they play fantastic at a film festival.
And Toronto, like other festivals, can help elevate films in terms of the awards race. But I also think they can start to separate films from the pack. And I'm wondering about movies like Joker with Joaquin Phoenix, or Judy with Renee Zellweger, or Just Mercy, a Warner Brothers movie about the criminal justice system. Do films like that come out of Toronto with a little bit of goodwill that maybe can help them succeed in a very crowded marketplace? Because these, outside of Joker, these are not films that are part of any big franchise.
I think that's really important for them to emerge from the film festival with their profiles raised, because it's so difficult to get attention if you're not part of a pre-existing franchise. So if you're a Just Mercy, if you're a Hustlers, you need this kind of attention so you can break through. One thing that I think is interesting, though, is if you look at the reception of Joker at Toronto compared to the reception at Venice. At Venice, the reception was completely rhapsodic. And while there were a lot of people who loved Joker at Toronto, I think people are very concerned about that movie. I think they're concerned about the kind of portrait of mental illness that it portrays and the way that it deals with violence at a time when gun violence is such a social issue. I expect that film to be extremely controversial when it opens.
And there are probably other movies at Toronto that will be equally polarizing. But when you think about crowd pleasers, I think of a movie like Ford versus Ferrari. Was there a movie that really struck you, that surprised you, that you came back from Toronto recommending to a lot of your friends and colleagues?
You know, for me, that movie was Waves, which was a film that on paper I was reading about and it sounded so just frankly depressing. I thought, you know, am I going to be able to sit through this? It's fairly late at night that the screening starts. And it was just electrifying. The way it was directed was so fresh and innovative. The performances were really deeply moving. And I thought it had a lot of profound things to say about grief and tragedy.
That is the film from filmmaker Trey Edward Schultz, whose last movie was a very scary film called It Comes at Night. Brett Lang is the executive editor for film and media at Variety. Brett, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up next on The Frame, Robbie Robertson from the band The Band. He's got a new record and a new documentary. Robbie Robertson's studio occupies a private section of the renowned Village Studios in West LA. And on the walls hang more than a dozen guitars, electric and acoustic, including a pretty scuffed up one that he used to write this song.
Take a load off Plenty. Take a load for free.
Robertson, along with Garth Hudson, are the last surviving members of The Band. That's the supergroup that backed Bob Dylan when he went electric and recorded classic songs like Up on Cripple Creek and The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. Robertson is the subject of an upcoming documentary titled Once We're Brothers. It's about his musical career, including his time with The Band. Robertson was sitting on his studio couch, and he and I discussed his latest record, which is called Cinematic. It's inspired by The Band and his childhood in Toronto and on the Six Nations Reserve in Canada.
You know, it's just storytelling to me, and a lot of times, you know, I feel like I'm just going to be as honest as I can about this, and here's what happened. Now, I'm going to tell it in, you know, in a certain rhythmic way. I'm going to tell it in a way that is, I hope, is good storytelling. So all of those things enter into it, but I try not to examine things under the microscope too much.
Because what happens to them when you do?
I don't know. It just gets a little bit contrived, perhaps. You're just getting too deep into your own madness.
I'm going to play a bit of the song Dead End Kid.
They said you'll never be nothing. You're just a dead end kid. Probably end up in prison. Or maybe down on the skids. No, you'll never be nothing. You're just a dead end kid. That's what they tell you.
When you think about a song like that, how close is that to your own life, about the idea that you could have become a dead-end kid?
Well, I heard that a lot when I was a kid, and I think it's an expression from the 1940s or something, you know, with the Bowery Boys. And
probably earlier.
Yeah, and I think Humphrey Bogart was in a movie, and it might have... But anyway, when I was growing up and I was going between the city, Toronto, and the Six Nation Indian Reserve, where my mom was from, a lot of times I couldn't help myself of talk about dreams and ambitions and things I want. And I was saying, I'm going to go out in the world, and I'm going to do this, and I'm going to go there, and I'm going to make music, and I'm going to write stuff, and I was going to do all this stuff. And they were like, you're tripping, kid, you know, and you're going to be lucky if you don't end up in jail. And I was like, what do you mean? So part of that was in Indian country, it was like, you're going to be disappointed because people around here have real limitations. And when you grow up, you're going to find out about that. And in the city, being surrounded so much with this possibility of gangster life, you know, all of these things and entering into it. And even when I joined Ronnie Hawkins, one day said to me, if I hadn't hired you, you would have probably ended up in prison. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, no, I saw some things.
Do you think there might have been a grain of truth in that, though?
There was possibilities in that you could have just taken a left at the wrong point and anything could have happened.
I want to play another song from the record. This one is called Beautiful Madness.
Oh, it looks like I'm in too deep and I can't sleep. Now maybe it's the pressure, maybe it's the dope. See, this is all, it's a little bit of both.
This is a song that deals with drug addiction, and in your documentary, drug addiction is a huge part of the story of the band, about what happened to Rick Danko, Levon Helm, Richard Manuel, about them becoming addicts. And I'm thinking about that song, about what addiction meant to you and to witness it and what it did to your friends. How do you go about taking something that is that personal and make a song about addiction?
Well, it's interesting now when you look back on it, because back then marijuana was considered the same as heroin. And so because of that, a lot of people thought, so what's the difference? Let's try this, let's try that. And what we didn't know was in people's nature, in people's a certain chip in their brain, some people can try it and say, oh, I liked it, or I didn't like it, or I don't want to do it, or, you know. And other people, it pushes a button. And that's called addiction. And we knew nothing about it. We knew nothing about alcoholism. We just thought, don't you think you're drinking a little bit too much? Why don't you cut back? You know, everybody thinks, oh, I can handle it. And that's what you would hear over and over again. But in this group, there was something about that addiction that really got in the way of our brotherhood and really got in the way of this was a band that if all five members weren't on point, it just didn't work the same. And trying to lift up one side of it that was bent over and everything was a big job, and a hard job, and a heartbreaking job, too.
We're talking with Robbie Robertson about his new album and his new movie. Guys made Big Pink with a band. It was a novel idea to actually leave the city, hole up someplace, and make music there. And I'm wondering if you've retained any of that, to isolate yourself from outside noise and figure out where you do your best creative work. We're in your studio now. Is it here? Is it somewhere else? How do you insulate yourself in a way that seemed to work so well on that album?
That was a dream of mine, to have a sanctuary, because I found early on when we would go from the basement of Big Pink, where we made the basement tapes, and then we would go into a recording studio, we were in somebody else's house. There was a big clock on the wall. There was guys there that said, well, you know, my shift is going to be up in an hour, so we better get this done. And I didn't think that we could do our best work on that circumstance. So the next record we made, the band, we got a house in the Hollywood Hills, Sammy Davis Jr.'s house, and recorded an album in the pool house there. The record company thought I was out of my mind, but I knew something about these guys that nobody else in the world did. And I knew that if we had our true, unique surroundings, that we could go to a place. And when we came out of that place, we had made music unlike anybody else in the world. And now I'm putting together the 50th anniversary of that extraordinary experience.
That isn't the only thing that happened 50 years ago. You guys played a little concert at Woodstock. And people who've seen the Woodstock concert movie probably don't know the band played at Woodstock. How come you guys didn't make the cut of that movie? And are you on the multi, like 30 some odd CD set that just came out?
When we went and played, it was at 9 o'clock, the last night of the festival. It was the height of the festival. There was 500,000 people in the audience. And when we got there, you could see that everybody was out there. They wanted to rock. They wanted to rip off their shirts. They wanted to roll in the mud. They wanted to get crazy. And when we went and played, it was like somebody coming and doing hymns. It was more of a spiritual. So you saw this go out over the crowd and everybody completely go to a different zone.
Say everything can be replaced. They say every distance is not near.
But we hadn't played hardly any concerts as the band. So then there was cameramen running around the stage and sticking a camera up in your face while you're doing it. But our manager, Albert Grossman, said, no cameras on the stage. We are not going to have that. This is a different kind of thing. And so Martin Scorsese, who was the assistant director on the film and was working on it, he was like, oh no, we got to shoot it from way back here.
Up next on The Frame, more of my conversation with musician Robbie Robertson. He tells me about his longtime collaboration with director Martin Scorsese. Let's get back to my conversation with musician Robbie Robertson from the band. In addition to his new solo record, Robertson wrote the score for Martin Scorsese's upcoming film, The Irishman. We pick up with the collaborative process between him and Scorsese.
You know, it's always different on the movies that I've worked on with him. I mean, starting back with Raging Bull. And every time, I mean, one of the interesting things for me is that every time it's a different challenge. Most of the times, you know, I read a version of the script, and then when they have usually a rough cut of it, I'll see what it is. And during the process, there's many times that we bounce ideas back and forth. And the most interesting thing that he says to me, in most cases, on most of the films, whatever you're doing, as long as it doesn't sound like movie music. And so that eliminates a lot.
It can and it can't. I mean, it's just like somebody tells you, just relax, don't get so uptight. The more you think about that, the more nervous you get.
Yeah.
Do you think there's anything you learn as a musician that you do in film work that you can apply to your own album work? Is there any carryover, or are they just completely distinct kinds of work?
No, I think they're all the same, as a matter of fact. And that's why my new record is called Cinematic, with an S, mind you. But on this particular record, especially, I was writing music for The Irishman. I was working on the film Once We're Brothers, a documentary. All of these things were mixing together, and I was also putting together the 50th anniversary of the band album that we're putting together, the box set for that. So all of these things were bleeding into one another. And even at the same time, I was doing paintings. And those paintings started to reflect the songs that I was writing and the movies I was working on and all of it. So it turned out to be like a big bowl of gumbo.
I want to ask you about the people you collaborate with now, people like Van Morrison, DJ Howie B, Citizen Cope, Glenn Hansard. What do you look for in partners now creatively, and what do they give you that maybe you wouldn't get if you were working solo?
You know, collaboration is a magical thing in movies, in music, in anything. And because I come from this brotherhood of the band, I always think, you know, one and one can make three. And to be able to do a song, a duet with Van Morrison, I don't know if it gets much better than that experience. And I love, and I was working on The Irishman. So Van comes to town. He's an Irishman. So all of a sudden, all these things are fitting together. Glenn Hansard comes to town. He's from Ireland, too. So a lot of it has to do with casting. And the same thing, you know, whether I'm using Chris Dave on drums or Jim Keltner or Pino Palladino on bass and everything, I just think this is the right casting for what I'm trying to create.
Do you think there's a point in any songwriter's career, and maybe your own, where the songs change from being prospective, like this is what I hope is going to happen and this is what's going to be in my future, versus reflective, this is my past and this has made me the person I have become? Because it feels like in this new record, a lot of it is kind of looking back the things that made you and your friends the people they are.
I feel like I'm doing what I need to do today and looking at tomorrow. But I carry this baggage with me. I carry these stories with me. I carry these experiences. And all of these things, they all end up, you know, playing a part in it. And that's life.
When I watched the documentary, I was thinking not only about how the band sounded, but about how they were a family in many ways. And to watch the film and think about the early deaths of some of your friends and the more recent deaths of people like Levon Helm, what does it feel like to lose a family that way? Because the band breaks apart, you go off and do your thing, but then to lose these people who are so close to you, you're still here, you're still doing music. How does that affect you?
Well, I wrote a song called Once We're Brothers because the idea is hard for me to imagine that I could have lost Richard Manuel, Rick Danko, and Levon Helm. That I could, you know, that part of this brotherhood is gone forever.
Once we're brothers, brothers no more. We lost our connection after the war.
I sat down to write a song. I had no idea what I was going to write about. And this came out. And I thought, I needed that. I needed this therapy or whatever you want to call it. But for me, it was a way to express my love for this brotherhood.
Robbie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, John.
And we close today with a sad farewell.
Here she comes again. When she's dancing beneath the starry sky.
Rick Ocasek, the frontman of The Cars, was found dead yesterday in his Manhattan apartment. The Cars made distinctive and classic pop music. When one of their songs came on the radio, the natural reflex was to turn up the volume, and that's just one of the reasons why The Cars are in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Rick Ocasek reportedly died from heart disease. He was 75 years old. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here tomorrow. You got your nuclear-